Hello, good morning. You join us on the 6th of May. It's Brunel Questions once again. Today we've got a special interview with John Leach coming up, which Alex did last week, 2 weeks ago?
Sometime recently.
And that will be followed by a bit of a chat about the local election results and also a look into the AV, which, because of time reasons, we don't actually have a result yet. We won't get that until about 8 o'clock tonight. So we'll sort of be talking on an abstract, sadly. Followed by that, we've got some guests coming up in the last half hour of the show. So we have David Simmons, who's a deputy council leader, I believe, for Ickenham.
Hillingdon deputy council leader and the councillor for Ickenham. Yeah.
Right, okay. Sorry. And we also have an interview with former student union president and hopefully Labour councillor, we haven't heard the result yet, standing in the Brighton area, Jay Patel. And then we'll just talk about the news in the world in general. So first... Alex, you obviously did the John Leach interview. How was he to interview?
He was an interesting character. I think, to be fair to say, his office wasn't the tidiest of offices I've ever visited. He seemed pretty pleasant, pretty busy, seems to be quite... I think we'll find out from the interview what he's sort of like. It's quite a good interview, I think. He told us quite a bit.
Okay.
Not afraid to speak his mind.
No, he's a former Brunel student.
He is, yes.
Did you talk about your times here?
Actually, it was the first sort of question I asked him. The first thing I sort of did was just sort of say, you know, sort of, you. Well, obviously, you're a Brunel alumni, sort of. Do you have fond memories of the place?
I did notice that after leaving university, he went on to work at McDonald's and the RAC. So yeah. There's a good future for all students.
Great future for all Brunel students.
Especially for history and politics students.
Yes.
Take note.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. And then, like I say, we'll move on to the local elections. There's a lot to go through in this show, and we'll have to be very, very stringent on getting through it. So we might as well start.
David Dimble will be like today.
Me?
No, us.
Oh, we will have to be.
Brunel elections.
I was going to take it as a compliment. Okay, right, we should probably start with the first bit from John Leach. So.
Yeah, definitely. It's a long time ago, and I suspect that Brunel has changed significantly since I was there. I was there between 1990 and 1994. And in my year, because I actually went to do a law degree, but changed at the end of the first year to history and politics. But the year that I was in had about 35 students. The year after after us had three times that number. Right. So I know there's been an enormous increase in the number of students across the board at Brunel, but particularly in subjects like history and politics.
And did you ask him when he'd last been to the campus, or if he'd revisited since or not?
I sort of touched on it. I was brief. Sort of, have you been back since? And he was like, well, not in a long time. He said, I'm sure a lot has changed. And I think so. I don't think he has come back, but you know.
No, 95, he'd be quite shocked at what's changed.
Yeah, I'm sure.
The amount
of
building work.
Different.
It surprises me. And that's one thing.
You've probably been here since almost 1995, so.
No. A little bit off. Next, like you say, he's a Lib Dem MP. Mm-hmm. And you asked him...
Well, basically, I just sort of wanted to know what inspired him to get into politics. When did he join? You know, has he been in politics all his life since he was a young age, or is it a more recent thing after he left university? Where did he join?
I joined the party at Brunel. I joined the student Liberal Democrats at Brunel and joined the party the first year I was at university. But I didn't actually get involved in student politics. I was one of those people that signed up to being a member of the party then, but then did absolutely nothing to start off with. But because at the time, I don't know whether it's still the case, most courses at Brunel were 4 years, and I did a thin sandwich course, which meant I did three work placements in the first, second and third year. Yeah. And in my second and third year, I worked for the party in Manchester, and that's what got me involved in politics. Right. And my first job at university.
Sorry, I just moved straight into the next one. I was lost in a world of getting my papers in order. So he was talking about joining the party there at university. I was impressed to find that there was a Lib Dem party on campus back in 90 whatever.
Yeah, I mean,
there isn't one now.
It's a bit of a surprise to Well, I think it's a bit of a surprise. I didn't really think Brunel's never seemed to be the place where politics is particularly active.
No.
Until sort of the tuition fees more recently and things like that have come in. So, yeah, I think it's really, really, really interesting.
Well, if you look at the history of Brunel, especially when tuition fees were being posted, there was a strong current of political activists. I don't know whether that was campus-wide, but if you look at stuff, for example, when Margaret Thatcher was given her honorary degree, very big protests from a lot of the students. So I don't know whether that's endemic of all the students in Brunel, or that was just the subset who were writing the paper and therefore put that spin on it.
But I know. John, one of the things John said was that Margaret Thatcher was one of the people that inspired him to go into politics, but not in a good way.
Good.
But yeah, no, it is interesting.
He also touched on student union politics and the fact that he never.
Yeah, he never got
ventured into it. You asked him on more than this, did you?
Yeah, I sort of touched on it and sort of said, you know, what did you get involved in student politics, and if not, what was it that turned you away from it?
At university, the biggest issue in Brunel student politics at the time seemed to be the cost of beer in the bar. At university, I was more interested in playing football all the time rather than being involved in politics, because I suppose football is my other sort of big involvement in my life. And at university, football always seemed to take precedence.
So he really wasn't your typical Brunel student then?
No, not really.
Didn't drink?
Wasn't really concerned with alcohol. Did a lot of sport.
Yeah, it's not like Brunel at all.
Not like Brunel at all, really, you know. Apathetic to politics at the time.
Yeah. Jaded. Yeah. So obviously he went from Brunel on from there. He's now become... How did he step... Did you know the steps to get up there?
Yeah, he became a councillor in the... From what I remember, the late 90s, early part of 2000. I can't quite remember the actual year. But and then basically he went on to win election in 2005 in the largest swing seat in the country, where the result flew massively away from Labour. And he won what... He's called it the understatement of the century when I said it was a surprise victory.
Yeah.
So it was a totally shocking win for him.
Okay.
He said he didn't really believe it himself for a while.
So he moved on, and now he's Lib Dem MP, and obviously it's not a great time to be a Lib Dem MP.
No, it's not. It's not a great time to be a Lib Dem MP, and obviously this was done before the local elections today, so it might be an even worse time now to be a Lib Dem MP.
Yes.
Particularly a Lib Dem MP in Manchester. Where the Lib Dems faced wipeout last night and lost all their seats. But the next thing I sort of touched on to, how do you think things are going for the Lib Dems? You know, how's everything going in the coalition?
Of course, I was one of only two MPs that didn't vote for the coalition. It was myself and Charles Kennedy. I did actually think there was a third person, but I was mistaken about that. So I suppose I perhaps hadn't been as enthusiastic about the coalition as some people were, but I do accept that in the end, because the Labour Party weren't prepared to consider a deal that would have included Labour and the Scottish and Welsh Nationalists, that it was really the only alternative. I rather suspect that if there had been a Conservative minority administration, there would almost certainly have been a second general election last year, and I would say almost certainly a Conservative majority. So we went into coalition because it was in the best interest of the country, and we were doing it not because we're close to the Conservative Party. I would say in terms of policies, I think we are a million miles from the Tories on many, many issues. But because of the extreme circumstances and the difficult economic situation that we found ourselves in, ultimately there was no alternative. Clearly there have been some difficult decisions that have been made, some of which I support, some of which I've gone along with a heavy heart, and then on some occasions I've felt unable to support it, things like tuition fees, for instance.
It's important he mentions tuition fees, because we'll come on to that. Like I say, he's one of the few to vote against the fees rise. But it's interesting what else he said. It sounds like he's struggling to justify where he is, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously if you're the only person that voted against joining the coalition, or one of two people that voted against joining the coalition, it's probably quite a difficult time for you to adjust to the way the other 50 odd MPs voted.
Yeah.
So I do think he's having a bit of a tough time, because I think he's getting, obviously, he's not like all the other Lib Dem MPs. He won a seat where maybe it's quite a safe Labour stronghold in the past, not really more of a mixed seat. So I think it's probably quite hard for him because he's probably got a lot of Labour support that just disenfranchised from the system in his constituency. And it's really hard. I think he's got to try to win. He knows he's got to try to win them over. And I think he's probably going to have a bit of a rough ride.
I found it interesting that looking at the stats I was given here. Obviously, he won with 17% in 2005.
Yes.
Even with the tuition fees promise and the big wave of Lib Dem revolution that seemed to be happening up and down the country, mainly, you have to say, focused around campuses. I remember here, you almost thought that I convinced myself that there would be a win because it seemed to be every other person I spoke to was going to vote Lib Dem. Mm-hmm. Only got 2%.
Yeah, he only got a 2% increase. On his share of the vote. I think it was an interesting, because I sort of know the seat relatively well. I worked in the seat for a while in an office there. And it was quite a high-profile battle. Labour picked one of their A-list rising star candidates, Lucy Powell, who did go on to become Ed Miliband's chief of staff.
Yes.
So quite a sort of high, prominent Labour figure. So I think it was quite a lot of tension in the seat. There was a lot of accusations of lies being spread by both sides. I think it's safe to say they don't like
they
each
don't
other
get on well.
No.
No. Okay. And next, we'll come on to the tuition fees and EMA and everything else. But first, we wanted to talk about the Barnsley by-election there.
Yeah, basically, when I did the interview, it was probably only a few days after the Barnsley by-election, and this is where the Lib Dems went from second place to sixth place, lost their deposit. Yes. They were beaten by obscure independent candidates. UKIP came second. They didn't have a good night, I think it's fair to say. And I sort of turned to him and said, does it mean anything? What does it mean? What does it mean for the party?
I don't think it shows anything at all. And I think the media narrative from the by-election is just ridiculous, frankly. I think I'm right in thinking that UKIP came second with about 8%. We came sixth with about 4%. And there was literally a few hundred votes between second and eighth place. It was a by-election that, frankly, Labour are always going to win, and I do question why people were prepared to vote for another Labour politician when their previous MP had been stealing from them. But, you know, that's politics for you. Labour won the by-election. They were always going to win the by-election. It was never going to be a by-election that we put a great deal of effort into, because it was one that we were never going to win. And if you compare the results in Barnsley to, say, Henley, or the other by-election very close to my constituency in Cheadle, both of which Labour lost their deposits, and in the Cheadle by-election particularly, it's not that long ago that Labour were polling 20-odd% of the vote in Cheadle constituency, and they lost their deposit in the by-election when Patsy Colton died. No one was saying that this was the end of the Labour Party when they lost their deposit. So I don't see why us losing our deposit in a by-election that we never had a prayer of winning, why that's suddenly the biggest news of the day.
Okay. So a bit of background on the Barnsley, why the by-election actually took place.
Yeah, as John picked up on there, the Labour MP had been stealing from the constituents. Basically, Eric Ilsley was convicted of election fraud and was sentenced to, I think he got a year in prison out of it. But yeah, he was the first one to be convicted over the election expenses. He'd basically been, from what I remember, he was filing for office space and claiming rent on an office space, and the office was actually in his house. So he was basically claiming for his extra money for his garage as well as claiming for rent on his home.
That would I define as stealing, yes.
Yeah, and so and basically he resigned, and a new candidate came in for the Labour Party. I think it was interesting, actually. They chose a former army captain or major, Dan Jarvis, really young sort of guy, and he romped home in the election with about 80% of the vote, as expected.
And it's interesting, he said that when you asked him, what does it mean? Obviously, this was a month ago.
Yeah.
So something like that, and there was no way to see where this was going. But obviously, looking at the local election results, which we'll come on to later,
Yeah.
It seems that it was a good portent of the future, and something should have been noted. I mean, if you look at I think these are councillors' elections here.
Yes.
Looking at Barnsley at the moment, Lib Dem aren't listed.
No, Lib Dem aren't listed there at all. I'm not sure who others are in Barnsley.
No, so I can't actually see who the others are on this table I'm looking at.
From what I remember, I think they're an independent sort of local-based group. But yeah, the Lib Dems don't exist on Barnsley Council.
No.
So obviously it's hardly Lib Dem territory.
No.
I think so.
And he was very dismissive of that loss. He seemed to say that it had no effect. And
yeah.
I mean, even saying stuff along the lines of BNP, UKIP, sorry, came second, we came sixth, probably a couple hundred votes, I think. I think you said it was more.
It was more like a couple of thousand. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I think, in all fairness to him, it's probably not the most telling of results. It wasn't a Labour safe seat. But, I mean, the only by-elections we've had in this Parliament so far, the third one is today, or the third one was last night, the result will come out today. They've all been Labour defence seats. There have not been a seat where the Coalition have actually had the territories tested.
And it's interesting, I think a lot of people are seeing it's the Lib. I mean, I saw something on Twitter before I came in. Someone had posted it's similar to the owner of the Duck Up Garden kicking the dog and thanking the owner. Because everyone is sledging the Lib Dems, but Tories haven't felt the backlash. But with the tuition fee hike coming in next September, I think they are going to feel it before too long.
Yeah, I mean,
if this is what everyone's doing is lashing out against the Lib Dems because of the tuition fees and broken promises and everything else like that, I think the Conservatives are also going to feel some backlash, but they're going to take some time.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think this because I moved on to tuition fees over this, but I mean, I think we have to remember as well last night, and we'll talk about it more later. There was only in most of the seats a third of the council up for election. The Lib Dems have suffered huge losses.
Mm.
They could face the same again next year, and it could all be due to the tuition fees. So that's what I touched upon next. I went back to tuition fees and said, you know, what made you vote against it in the end?
I made it very clear from day one that I wouldn't support it. And I spoke in the debate, and I've made it very clear that there are two big reasons why I won't support an increase in tuition fees. One is I fundamentally believe that an education to a first degree should be free. I've always believed that and always will believe that. And every opportunity I get to vote against tuition fees, I will do. And I actually think it's not just the student or graduate that benefits from a university degree. Having a well-educated population is good for the country. It's not just good for the individual. And if people get a good degree, get a good job, are well paid, they pay more tax, they pay it back. They pay back that education that they've got. So I just fundamentally believe that education should be free. On the specifics of the changes, there is no doubt that the changes that have been implemented are actually make the fee structure more progressive than they currently are. And a quarter of all graduates will actually pay back less under the new scheme than they did under the current scheme, with fees only at £3,000 or so. The difference is that no one ever goes to university believing that they're going to be in the bottom 25% of graduates. When you go to university, you think you're going to university because you'll get a good education, you'll get a good job, and therefore you will assume that you'll pay back every penny of those tuition fees. So I actually think that by increasing tuition fees, people will be put off from going to university.
So while he may have a view that's against what the Lib Dems say, he did toe the party line to an extent there, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. He started off the answer pretty much criticising the whole tuition fee system, and then sort of went, oh, but wait, everything's better now because it's fairer. But I think he makes a fair point when he said the big problem is the lowest 25% will pay less, but no one ever believes they'll be in that lowest 25% of earners. Everyone goes to university thinking, I'm going to be the best of the best, I'm going to earn a lot of money. And I think particularly in somewhere like Manchester, the south side of Manchester, where he's the MP4, I think a lot of kids sort of sat in the living room at home with their parents would have sort of been looking around and saying, well, I'm not going to be able to go to university now because it's going to cost me too much. And I think that's sort of what he's touching upon there.
Mm. And there's something that was also mentioned by Andy Burnham when we interviewed him in
December.
Quite a while ago,
yeah.
No, no. November? It was November just before the vote.
Yes.
So it was the day before the vote, actually. So that's interesting. We've got two different parties there, but both from the same geographical sort of... You know, they're both...
Northwest MPs.
They're not Eton, you know, Cameron-esque people. So there's a real feeling that... I don't know. I think people are starting to understand that the tuition fees, while the coalition has to toe the party line, you have to, of course, because it's your party. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there are people who are still starting to see the cracks. And I think a lot of people in unsafe seats are starting to worry about the future. Because mm-hmm. if they continue to say the tuition fee thing is great and the rise was fine, then they're going to find themselves in trouble when it comes to the election, I think. Mm-hmm.
No more so than Nick Clegg, probably, in Sheffield.
Yeah, he's feeling the... I think he's feeling the pinch, isn't he?
Yeah, just a little bit.
So what do we go on to next, then?
Basically, after this, I thought, after we touched on tuition fees, another interesting issue a couple of weeks ago that was being chatted about a lot was the Education Maintenance Allowance, and EMA. And I just wanted to basically just sort of find out what you thought. And, you know, did you think we should be scrapping EMA? Is this sort of, you know, was it a waste of money? And was the new system that was going to be implemented going to be any better?
Actually, I think EMA is generally a good thing. It helps people who are from the lowest income families. I think the problem with the proposed changes is that there isn't enough money in the or there isn't going to be enough money in the proposals to provide for people who need some financial support. For me, the EMA has to pay for travel, and it has to pay for some level of subsistence. It can't be right that if you are a person who comes from a family that's entitled to free school meals, that if you stay in school after post 16 you'll get a free school meal, but if you go to college you won't. And in some areas schools aren't available, colleges are the only option. So it can't be fair that people are being discriminated against in that way. So whatever replaces EMA, and let's not forget, Labour are going to scrap EMA. Whatever they say now, they were actually going to scrap EMA when they made education up to 18 compulsory. But the reality is that we're not going to have enough money in the system to provide for travel and to provide for subsistence. And that's why I can't support any changes that won't make that provision.
It's a bit of a confusing answer there, but in essence, he's not a fan of EMA, I think.
I think he's saying it needs changes, but the principle of it and overall it's a good system. I think he's worried that the money that, though the proposed replacement of EMA isn't going to have enough money. So I think what he kind of wants is basically a reform. I think his problem seemed to be, from chatting to him, that the problem is that the pupils that receive it just get given the money and they could spend it on what they like. And I think he's sort of suggesting it should be a travel and a food subsistence. Yeah. And I think maybe he's sort of suggesting if there were ways to safeguard against that, then that would probably be the best sort of system.
Another friendly dig at Labour there as well.
Yeah, as the interview went on and on, he seems to take more and more pops at Labour. I think it's fair to say that he doesn't get along with the Labour Party, particularly in South Manchester.
Okay. Next, he did talk about Hillsborough. We're going to gloss over that because we don't have the time.
Yeah, it's quite a long answer that he gave on. But basically, he was asked a couple of years ago, if he could remove one piece of legislation, what would it be? And he said it would be the removal of the ban of standing at football matches. And I said, well, that was brought in after Hillsborough. Mm. So is that a sensible idea? And he was basically talking about this idea of safe standing, which is what they have in Europe, where you have a designated seat and there are barriers up with seats on them. But the spaces are changed and shaped, so
right.
You're designed to stand there. However, at European football matches, where laws are still in that you have to sit down,
yes,
there is a seat that pops out of the back of the barrier behind you, and you can sit down.
Okay. So it's
50-50. And then I think he sort of touched upon Hillsborough and said at the same time, I think there's a lot of needs for justice in the Hillsborough campaign. So I think that was a positive answer.
Obviously, all this interview will be put up uncut.
Yes.
On our iTunes feed, which we'll talk about towards the end of the show.
Yeah.
But next, wanted to talk about, like you say, he's taking a few digs at Labour.
Yeah, he takes quite a few pops at Labour, and I think I just wanted to touch upon here whether he does have any friends across the aisles, and does he really get on with the Labour Party or what?
Well, I think it would be safe to say that certainly in Manchester I'm not Labour's most popular politician, but it doesn't stop people in Manchester or people in this place constantly asking me to defect to the Labour Party. I've lost count of the number of times I've been asked to cross the floor, and I, at one point I was tipped as being the most likely MP to cross the floor, which, frankly, if anyone knew what went on in Manchester politics and the animosity between the two parties in Manchester, they would know that's not going to happen. Yes, the campaign in 2010 was pretty unpleasant. I would say that I've been the victim of a pretty vicious campaign by the Labour Party ever since I got elected in 2005. And it's all to do with Labour believing that they have a God-given right to have the MP for Manchester Withington. And until they get over the fact that people decide who their MP is going to be, not political parties, until they get over that, they're always going to believe somehow that they've been cheated out of their God-given right to have the MP.
So it's fair to say he doesn't have many friends, certainly in Manchester.
I think he might have friends in Manchester,
sorry.
Just not Labour politicians.
Yeah, that's fair, sorry. using words like victim, he obviously identifies that they are the enemy and there is no love.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's quite a lot of animosity between them, as he says. Interestingly, it is a really tense issue up there, and I noticed that two Lib Dem councillors defected to Labour over what they said was over what they argued was because of John's campaign. They defected to Labour over there, but he sort of dismissed that and said it was a non-issue, really.
Next, we're talking about we'll talk about it later. The mayoral race in London 2012.
Yes.
But you moved on to, well, I suppose, their candidate.
Yeah, because obviously, I mean, it's being billed by the media as Boris versus Ken round two. Mm. But one person who's put his name forward for the Mayor of London Place is obviously Lembit Opic, the colourful Lib Dem politician. And I asked, what does he think? Would Lembit be a good mayor for London?
I'm not a big fan of elected mayors, personally, because I think the contests end up being more about a beauty contest rather than a political contest. And that's not to suggest that Lembit's good looking. Please don't think that I think that. But I actually think that it's about personalities rather than politics. And it's important that political parties have somebody who is high profile. And I think it's fair to say that Lembit is high profile. He's actually a very astute politician. I think sometimes he has a tendency to say one or two things that perhaps further down the line he might say, well, maybe I shouldn't have said that. But he's always courted a bit of controversy. But he is a serious politician. People know who he is. And I think he would be a very good London mayor if he was elected.
I thought that the opening statement when he said, I'm not a big fan of large paws, I assumed it was being followed with Lembit Opic and we were going to get an entirely different answer, as it is, he's not a fan of the elected mayoral system. But while not a winning reference, he's still a fan of Lembit to an extent.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the Lib Dems seem to quite like Lembit because some people, they might think he's a bit sort of daft and a bit of a... He sort of chats a lot of...
It worked for the last one.
Boris. Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's the have I got news for you candidate, and that's something that I mentioned to him. All of them have been on the show.
I think Lembit a little bit went up in everyone's expectations when after his pretty definitive loss in the 2010 elections, that night actually.
Yeah,
he was on Have I Got News for You?
Yeah,
and took it all with him.
He got an
incredible grace.
He got an absolute ribbon. But yeah, he did it. He did it really well. And I think that's what they need. They need someone that everyone knows because, let's face it, it is a beauty contest in London. It's a personality thing. It's like a presidential election.
And it has been said that Brian Paddock has mentioned that he'd like to put his hat back in the ring for that. But I think, as proved last time, he became, as everyone was doing the debates last year, everyone was saying, I agree with Nick. I agree with Nick. The mayoral debates that a couple of years ago seemed to be Ken and Boris talking, and Brian saying, I agree with something they said. I'm here still. And it's clear that he went from that, and I think 6 months later, he was suddenly in the jungle doing I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here,
yeah,
eating kangaroo scrotums or whatever.
Yep.
So it's not exactly the year he was going to remember.
No.
But whether he'll make the serious bit of it, I don't know. We should probably go and just wrap up some bits and pieces of this interview before we move on to next pieces. So if we want to do the quick fire round almost.
Yeah, I just asked him a couple of quick questions. First of all, I wanted to know what he thought his biggest achievement in politics was.
I often get asked this question, and I suppose the biggest political achievement in real terms was actually getting elected in the first place. I overturned an 11,500 majority, and it was the biggest winning swing in the country, if you excluded Brent East, that we'd won in a by-election a couple of years earlier. So that was no mean feat. It was a big achievement, and it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't me that, it wasn't just my achievement, it was the party's achievement for running a spectacular campaign. But actually the biggest the things that that I like the most about being a politician and that I get the most benefit from are those individual cases that you deal with. I've stopped one or two people from being evicted from their homes or losing their homes by dealing with individual pieces of casework, and actually they give me far more pleasure than perhaps some of the bigger things that you potentially can achieve in Parliament.
A bit of a standard answer. The best thing I've got is the achievement of being elected. But then also he moved on to some more personal issue. I think you said as well when I've spoken to you about it, that the individuals are what matter. Doing the various bits of casework can be really important.
I mean, it's when you get that email. I've had it when I've worked in MP's office in the past. When you get that email that just sort of says, you know, oh, thank you, you saved this, or you know, thank you, you saved this, or that sort of thing. You know, it's what sort of happens. People do tend to be quite thankful for all the work you do, and I think that's the most positive part of politics. But then I moved on to ask him on the flip side what his most embarrassing moment was.
I think the most embarrassing thing has got to be my failure to renew my car tax whenever it was. I can't remember which year it was now. I, for some reason, after my car had been 3 years old, I didn't receive the renewal form, and someone from the Labour Party had spotted that I hadn't it was actually 6 days out of date, and it had been spotted by someone from the Labour Party, and it made the local papers, but as a transport spokesperson for the party at the time, it was pretty embarrassing. Interestingly, having got that bad publicity in the papers, I've spoken to loads of people who've said that the same thing happened to them, that they didn't realise that their car tax was out of date. But you know, you can't expect not to be pulled up for something like that.
My favourite point, interestingly,
I found out it was out of date. I went to one of my local schools, Barlow High School.
So yeah, there was John Leake talking about his most embarrassing moment, and I think he was quite honest in it. I think it is a bit of a big mistake. So and that basically wraps up our interview with John Leake. I think we're ready for our first interview, aren't we?
I believe so. Hello, David.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, Alex, would you like to?
Yeah, sure. Hi, David. Basically, what we sort of wanted to ask you was sort of looking at the picture of how things are going this morning. How's the night gone overall, do you think, for the Conservatives with local elections up and down the country?
Well, it looks like being a very good night for the Conservatives. Excuse me. The media yesterday were saying that if the Conservative Party came out having lost 400 or less council seats, then that should be considered a good result, given that there is a Conservative-led government in Downing Street at the moment. And as of now, it looks like the Conservatives have gained around 37 council seats, which is a pretty positive result. And the big news seems to have been that the voters, particularly in the north of England, are turning against the Liberal Democrats.
Okay. I mean, obviously you said that there's been some good results. Do you think there's also been some sort of bad results for the Conservatives in general? I mean, sort of Birmingham, for example, you lost six seats in Birmingham, where you were previously the largest party. Are there some sort of areas, particularly the Midlands maybe, where you've not done as well as you would perhaps liked?
Well, it's very early in the day, I think, to be sure of the detail. But I think Birmingham is a city where the Conservatives have been part of an overall controlled administration. And I think there probably will be some discussions to take place about what that means for who runs the council. So I think those results can't necessarily be interpreted as being particularly good or particularly bad until we get the big picture. But based upon what we know already, it does seem that the Conservative vote nationally is holding up very well.
And David, I just wanted to ask you about, you've worked in both hung and in majority administrations as a councillor. I wonder what your experiences are, if you can sort of convey a slight thought of what may be going through Nick Clegg's head right now as part of a coalition there.
It's an interesting reflection, and in fact my experience of working in hung councils is why I'm quite strongly in favour of the first past the post electoral system. I think whichever electoral system you have has advantages and disadvantages, but for me the big strength of first past the post is it tends to result in administrations, whether nationally or locally, which have a clear majority and therefore are able to say this is what we promised that we would do, and to be held accountable to the voters for having done it or not done it at the end of your time in office. And during the 8 years when Hillingdon had a hung council, the big frustration I think for both us and the Liberal Democrats who voted to install Conservative administrations every year was that neither of us were really in a position to do what we were promising to do. It was quite tough to tackle the really difficult issues, because unless you have a majority, it tends to mean that the political sensitivities result in them being set aside for the future. And as a result, difficult things don't get addressed, and it means that the council, or indeed the country, doesn't make as much progress as it could otherwise. And I think, talking to a lot of voters, one of the things that they seem to like about the first past the post electoral system is that it's very clear to them what the government has done. This is its manifesto, i.e. has it done what it promised to do, and it's also very clear how to get rid of the government if you feel that it hasn't lived up to your expectations. Mm-hmm. Whereas when we look across Europe, what we see with first past the post is a lot of compromises, a lot of coalitions where potentially unpopular governments that haven't delivered on their promises are voted against in large numbers by the public, but then kept in office because they've been able to do a deal between their politicians and the politicians of other parties.
Okay, I mean, you've touched on AV there, David, a little bit, and said that you're a supporter of First West Post. And from what we've seen from the exit polls, it looks like that the consensus would have been or is going to be with the no vote. Do you think this suggests that the public don't want electoral reform, or is it just not a priority for them at the moment with what's currently going on in the country?
Well, I think it's firstly fair to say it's not a priority for the public, that when you look at the polls going back over many years, people are asked what are the things they're concerned about, and things like the health, the economy, law and order tend to be far more significant. There isn't a great clamouring for electoral changes. But also, I think it does come back to the basic point that every form of electoral system has advantages and disadvantages. First past the post produces strong, accountable governments and is very simple and easy to operate. But on the other hand, it tends to exclude third parties disproportionately to their support.
Okay, and just sort of finally, David, very quickly. Obviously, this time next year, we didn't have any elections in London this year, but this time next year we'll be coming up to the Assembly and mayoral elections. Would you like to hazard any predictions as to how that's going to go very quickly?
Well, I think if the elections this time are any sort of predictor for the future, then clearly there will be pressure on the Conservatives as part of the Assembly to maintain the vote. And certainly the Labour Party did quite well in London in a lot of the local elections last year. But I don't think that comes even close to being likely to remove Boris Johnson from City Hall. I think he's a mayor who has had a couple of years now to settle in and is getting to the point where a lot of the things he started, he promised to do in his manifesto, are being delivered. A lot of work being done on the tube system, air conditioning and so on, the new metropolitan lines going in and out of Uxbridge. The Crossrail project is really up and running. The work's being done in all the stations. You know, Boris bikes being rolled out across the capital and things like that. So I think people can see now what he's actually done. And unlike his predecessor, he has been a mayor who has come to Hillingdon a lot, has taken a lot of interest in other issues about making sure we have enough resources for school places, for example, which is a big, big local issue. Whereas his predecessor, who appears to be the one standing again, went to Havana more times than he went to Hillingdon during his time. And for that reason, I think Boris is likely to be re-elected.
Okay, thanks for that, David.
Thank you very much.
We're out of time here. It's David Simmons, Deputy Leader of Hillingdon Council. Thanks very much, David. Okay, so that was a very sort of honest answers there, saying David seems to quite happily admit that the Conservatives will be tested next year in London. We'll obviously have to wait another year to see how it goes, but just while we're getting our next guest ready, let's have a look at how things have gone up and down the country and give you a bit of a taste for what's been going on. I think the Lib Dems, it's safe to say, have taken a bit of a battering. They've lost overall so far. I don't even think we're halfway through results coming in yet. They've lost 300 councillors almost, basically defending 640 seats, and they now only have 340 seats. So they've had quite a bit of a thing. They've lost four councils. It's been a very good night for Labour in England, getting 12 councils. Probably the biggest win is probably in Hull, where they took the council completely from the Lib Dems. And basically sort of it's become a bit of a whitewash. So all in all, a mixed night for Labour. Mixed night for the Conservatives, very bad night for the Lib Dems as it looks. And I think we've got our next guest ready, haven't we?
Yep. Our next guest is Jatin Patel, who is standing in which area is it exactly, Jay?
Brighton area,
For Labour, and was also a former student union president. The first question I want to ask you is how did you get into it, really?
Yeah, well, I mean, last year I decided to get in contact with the Labour Party, mainly as a reaction to not wanting the Tories to win in the general election. So kind of got involved by campaigning with them, and as things went on, I decided to run for council as well.
And how's it all gone for you? I know you said there's no result until sometime later today, but how do you feel it's going?
Yeah, I mean, the area I'm running in, I'll be honest, is a Tory stronghold and has been for a long time. So, I mean, we're not expecting a positive result, but nonetheless, the experience has been good. I mean, it's been great getting out there, understanding kind of the voters' kind of issues and working with my fellow members in the area. But as I said, it's been Tory for about 30 odd years now, so I think the effort's more important than the actual result.
Hoping to make a dent more than a result.
Something like that, yeah.
We talked to John Leach earlier as an MP with the Lib Dems, a former Brunel student. Would that be something you'd look for in the future, maybe moving up in the stage?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always been an ambition of mine. I enjoy representing people. Enjoyed my time at Brunel, doing it for 2 years, and I'd love to do it one day in the future for sure. I mean, being in Brighton might be more difficult considering the green revolution that's taking over down here, but nonetheless, it's definitely something I'd like to do in the future.
We're also just asking guests their thoughts on the new AV system. We just spoke to David Simmons of Hillingdon Council, who was very anti AV, I have to say. Just wondering on your thoughts and how you think it's going down there for you guys.
I think the campaign both for and against AV has been admired by the fact that both sides have kind of made it more political than actually using the opportunity to explain to people the pros and cons of the system. And personally, I don't think it's a bad idea. I don't think it's the perfect solution, but I think it was an ideal compromise and something that should have been probably explained a lot better to the electorate. I think it's unfortunate that it hasn't happened. I think it's been used as a scapegoat for Nick Clegg and the Dems, and used as a kind of whip against them, which is a shame because I think it deserved a kind of a greater argument and a greater kind of presentation of the facts, and unfortunately it's been turned out that way. But personally, I'm pro-AV. I think it's a good system. I think it's something that allows our democracy to be extended further, and something which, unfortunately, after today's result, I'm guessing is going to be a no. Will probably be put on the shelf for years to come.
Okay, something I just wanted to pick up on, Jay. Lord Ashdown this morning, former Lib Dem leader, said that the Lib Dems were probably a little bit naive and probably thought everything was going to be a bit too rose-tinted for them, and that people of Britain would understand that understand that it was a compromise that they made and not a betrayal. Would you say that's a fair analysis, or would you say they've betrayed their voters?
No, well, I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword, I feel, because whilst the voters are going to, someone might call it a betrayal, I think there's a case to be told about. You know, when you're put in a position of power, that you need to make certain compromises to ensure that you're effective. But nonetheless, there were a set of priorities and a set of promises made which have been broken, and those can never be gone back on, unfortunately. And so you've got to deal with the consequences.
Okay, thanks very much for joining us. And we do wish you all the best of luck. Hope you let us know how it gets on.
I will do.
And we'd love to have the show on, have you on the show in future.
Yeah, definitely, mate. Cool.
Okay. Thanks very much. That's Jay Patel. Thank you very much for joining us. Two guests there. Different views on AV. And like I say, we won't know until, I think it's 8 o'clock this evening, we've been promised.
At the latest, yeah. I mean, I think they're hoping to have a bit of a result earlier on. But I mean, I think the problem is you've got to rely on seats that are going to be slow at counting. You know, I mean, I think Sunderland finished their election count for the local elections at midnight last night. It took them less than 2 hours to get everything done.
Yeah.
Other seats hadn't started until 6 a.m. So I think that's going to be the problem for everyone. I think we're going to move on now.
We're
going to
race through everything else in the world. There's not a lot's been happening this week. It's fair to say, you know, it's been quiet, hasn't it?
Apart from one or two big issues.
So if we just run down this sheet essentially here, because it's the best way I'm going to do the order. Very quickly, we're going to talk about the 2012 mayoral elections. We all know that Ken Livingstone will be the Labour candidate who beat Una King by 68.8% of the vote.
Yeah, I mean,
with 68%.
I think it was interesting. I mean, I think it showed that the Labour Party in London, not to be too critical of them, but I think it shows that they weren't really ready for the change. They were quite happy to stick with Ken.
I think Una would have been a better move. She's...
Una, I think, I mean...
Younger, she's and not to say that this is an instant vote-getter, but she's young, she's female... and black.
Yeah,
and that is something that...
She's a new face, I think, is probably a nice way to sort of
Ken
describe
very much represents the old guard, I think.
Ken very much is the old guard. He's been around London politics for a long, long time. Una's a very fresh face. I mean, her only big downside would have been that she was beaten by George Galloway in 2005, but I think that was a bit of a vicious campaign.
He had a big wave of support, though.
Fair to say it was a blip. But I think she's a very competent politician. She's now obviously been made a baroness, so she now sits in the House of Lords. You don't need to get elected anymore. You just get pushed into the but yeah, I think it would be interesting next year to see.
And we also know that Boris will be the Conservative candidate, even though there were rumours floating around. I think he declared in October, but there were rumours floating around that he would be running for an MP seat due to he's had some high profile clashes with the Tory government. It's fair to say.
Year. I think it's one thing he's done really well, actually, to be fair to Boris, I read a brilliant article the other day, and it basically sort of says that it was basically talking about how Boris seems to get his name into everything in a positive manner. There are rumours going around that there's going to be phone lines installed on the tube, and no one really believes that. But Boris has put a brilliant story out about how this is going to be working with the Chinese government, and it's great for big business. There's also obviously Boris Island that they're planning to use an old Navy warship to be a multi-million pound dock. And however, EasyJet's owner has turned around and kindly informed Boris it would cost billions of pounds to set up, billions of pounds to convert it, and billions of pounds to run. And you would never make any money off having a warboat as a runway in the middle of the River Thames in London.
Okay.
But so, yeah. It's
he definitely gets stories out there. Whether you like or dislike him, he's there.
Yes, obviously.
and obviously the election's coming. Lib Dems is a harder picture to see. They're not going to turn out. They're not going to have a result until the 15th of October. This year, so they're holding their cards close to their chest on the result of who's going to be their candidate. The front runners are obviously Lembit. There's also Dwayne Brooks, who was a friend of the murdered schoolboy Stephen Lawrence.
Yep.
A woman called Caroline Pidgeon, who I had a look at last night, and the only notable policy she has is she wanted to instigate a travel anywhere on one bus ticket for an hour. So you get on a bus, you pay your 150, whatever it's called these days, that gets your ticket, and you can bus hop with the same ticket. But that's what I've got off her. That's
interesting. I think
it's a nice idea.
It would be great for students. I'm sure students would love that. It'd be a great way to start a night out.
Yes.
An hour's ticket, see where you end up. Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think I'm not sure why they're staying so late and they're holding back.
They've said
from picking a result. I mean, Labour and the Conservatives have already got their candidates in. I think
they could be worried about a floor fight, and also if this is the kicking that the Lib Dems are getting countrywide, the fear is if you put a figurehead to the Lib Dem party, they could become the kicking boy.
Hmm. But at the same time, I think if they put someone in early, you may get what's happened with Boris, where no matter what happens in central government, if the Conservatives do something that people deem unpopular, Boris tends to come out and criticise it, and he tends to come out of it quite well. So maybe, I mean, obviously, you had Chris Huhne today in Eastleigh, in his constituency. They've gained 3 seats in his council elections there.
Yeah.
And he's been someone that's vocally been critical. He had an argument with George Osborne in cabinet last week, apparently, and was swearing and shouting at him. So it kind of works.
And other people going for the mayoral seat, these are more the sort of the real dark horses for your money. Brian Paddock, again, wants to have another go, but I don't think he's going to get the nomination. He was roundly beaten. And then 2 actresses to go into the mix, apparently Joanna Lumley and Floella Benjamin, who's
interesting.
The Chancellor of Exeter University. I don't know where those names have come from, but they are in the rumours.
I think Joanna seems to be quite a positive Lib Dem supporter, and I can kind of see it happen. I mean, there was rumours, actually, that Sir Alan Sugar was going to be Labour's candidate in this thing to put a high-profile person up against Boris. And obviously Sir Alan's a vocal supporter of the Labour Party. And I think it may have worked. And I think Joanna Lumley would be a brilliant shout for them. I don't necessarily think she would win, but someone who's high-profile and people know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it worked with Martin Bell in 1997.
Yeah.
You know, everyone knew him.
There is also the Green Party candidate, Jenny Jones, who I believe... Are we talking too soon? Or have I got the wrong person there?
Jenny Jones? Yes, the Green?
Yes.
Jenny Jones. Jenny Jones is actually former deputy mayor under Ken Livingstone. Livingstone first ran as an independent, Jenny Jones, the Green London Assembly member, who is going to be on our show soon, was deputy mayor. So there's a possibility of her running for the Greens.
And you mentioned, just moving on here, you mentioned the... Sarlan Sugar, looking at running for a mayoral position. Well, his counterpart across the sea, who also does The Apprentice, is looking for running for a slightly different position.
Yeah, very slightly different. Donald Trump, obviously, running for president. And he's come up with a great news story this week that he's basically proven that Barack Obama is American.
Yes,
which is news that none of us knew. It's really exciting stuff.
If anyone who hasn't seen it, please do go on YouTube and look up the Washington White House Correspondents' Dinner for this year, and the opening address from Barack Obama is quite excellent.
It's something special, yeah.
He does reference Donald Trump's new findings, I think.
Yes, I think.
But obviously, he's looking at doing it, and if he doesn't get the Republican nomination, he says he will stand as an independent, so his name will be on the ticket come what may.
Well, yeah, I mean, it happened with Ross Perot in 1992 in America. Ross Perot put millions of pounds or millions of dollars into his own campaign and funded it. Donald Trump is in the position to do the exact same. I think that what's interesting is with obviously the big news story this week being the death of Osama bin Laden, Barack Obama may have already secured the 2012 election in the same way George Bush did in 2004 when new tapes came out from bin Laden, conveniently timed just before the election. And just as this killing has come, as Barack Obama was facing a bit of a slump in the polls, he'd been attacked recently over the last few weeks. But he may have secured it up because Americans, obviously, big issue over there is security. And if he can be the one that says, I was the one that got Osama.
It doesn't hurt a Democrat to do a big thing with a military campaign. Other people going for Republican seat, Palin's going to come back, of course. We can't see it.
I hope she gets it. I really do.
Romney, Huckabee as well.
Yeah, Mitt Romney, interesting choice. He's a Mormon. So everyone says that's his biggest downfall. They're very hard to criticise him on other things. But he's actually a supporter of universal healthcare as well, as Barack Obama keeps reminding everyone. So that would be something they couldn't attack him over.
Well, there's quite a few. I mean, this is something I don't know whether that's a thing that's coming out because of Barack Obama's success, and the Democrats seem to be quite strong over there. because there's also Ron Paul, who's incredibly liberal for a Republican. Yeah. He's opposed to the federal death penalty, opposed to torture, but then I think most people are. He wants to revise...
Dick Cheney.
Sorry? Well, yes. He wants to revise the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I know it's already been done, but this is something that was printed a couple of years ago. He wants drug regulation to be done at state level. There's no need for the federal to get involved. He does obviously have some Republican tendencies.
Yeah,
he's pro the guns, anti civil rights,
low government spend and stuff like that. Fiscally conservative.
He did say the Civil Rights Act not only violates the Constitution, but reduces individual liberty, and it also fails to promote racial harmony and a colorblind society. And he called Martin Luther King a communist.
Interesting. It's always interesting when people throw accusations at. Yes. Historical figures.
Certainly when they're dead and they can't respond.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, actually, because I think what I've noticed with the names that have been sort of pushed around as to who's going to be the Republican nominee, none of the big popular Republicans who everyone suspects will be the next Republican president if they win are actually putting their names into the hat. The Marco Rubios, Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, obviously has dealt with quite a lot of issues, hurricanes and stuff like that. And Scott Brown, the new Republican senator for the state of Massachusetts.
At the moment, it seems to be, forgive the expression, weirdos and whack jobs. Because you've got Ron Paul, who having read about, I seem to think he's got some good policies, but of course he does have some odd tendencies to say some odd things. I think it's Gingrich?
Gingrich, yeah, Newt Gingrich.
Trying to get the pronunciation right. He's a quote I've actually found, the first quote I looked at when I saw on his wall, "I'm not a natural leader, I'm too intelligent."
Yeah.
So
they're interesting characters. I think.
And then Rudy Giuliani, who is, I don't think it's too far to say, a horrible man.
Yeah, I think the problem for the Republicans is very few of the good, in inverted commas, good candidates actually want to run for office this time, because it's hard to beat an incumbent. Very few people, only three candidates in America have ever beaten the incumbent.
Doesn't happen in student union politics either.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, it sort of suggests a lot for the Republicans that they're probably not going to be able to beat Obama, despite his unpopularity at the moment. I mean, Bill Clinton did worse than Obama in 1994 midterms and still won a resounding victory against Bob Dole. Again, a boring Dole candidate that was a bit odd in 1996.
And that 1996 was also just after the Monica Lewinsky transgression has come to light. So you can really make a mistake as a president and still win out. We should probably also move on to the Obama. Now I've done it. CNN did it, now I've done it. The Osama bin Laden thing. He should change his name to something like John.
Yeah. Well, obviously, the thing American. That Fox News published in 2008, as much as they could, they kept saying Obama-Biden really quickly when they were talking about the elections, and it sounded like Osama bin Laden, the way they were pronouncing it. But that's Fox News being just brilliant.
So if we want to talk about the Osama bin Laden, and I'm going to be very clear that I'm saying Osama. It's all very mysterious the way it happened. Obviously, it's been a lot of calls for the pictures. I'm fine without the pictures, thank you very much. I don't really need to see pictures of a dead body, but the results are very sketchy.
Yeah, I think it was the quickness of everything that sort of caught everyone by surprise. I mean, the whole thing apparently only took 40 minutes, and that's to get in and out of a protected compound, kill the body, remove the body, search for intel, take the intel. And if all that took 40 minutes, there must have been some very, very well-trained military. I mean, I know they're obviously meant to be America's elite. They were very quick.
Well, there's also, you've got to say, there's also a thing that they must have been incredibly well kitted out and supplied. So they must have had some sort of help, not obviously trying to instigate the fact that the Pakistan would be helping, but you think someone who, and I believe it's been reported that he was on kidney dialysis.
Yeah, I mean, obviously he's always had illnesses.
But for someone to be on dialysis, you need to be pretty stationary, not moving around too far. You can't go too far. Anyone who's had it will probably testify to the fact that you're not exactly the most mobile person. Yeah. So Pakistan must have known he was there and must have had some.
Yeah, inkling. I mean, when you're not the only one to suggest that. I mean, Hamid Karzai, the Afghanistan president, was the first person on the news instantaneously saying, you know, this was all Pakistan's fault. And Christopher Hitchens, probably one of the most intelligent Americans, is very well-known atheist, who is himself being treated for cancer, so he knows a lot about medication and being bedridden and things like that. Christopher Hitchens said, I don't get this. He said, we're pumping $700 million a year into Pakistan, and it looks like they may have knowingly been harboring a terrorist. I mean, one thing people have to remember about Abbottabad, which is where bin Laden was found, is it's less than a mile from the Pakistani military academy, which is the equivalent of Sandhurst. And
you fail to believe that you can live under the nose of the military.
This was a three-story building built in 2005 with a 15-foot compound wall, and no one seemed to pick up on it. And
no,
they've sort of
it's funny that
they've said it was a slip, and they said, well, you know, we're not God, we're only human. But
something that maybe is indicating of that is the fact that there's an immense silence from the U.S. Department of the CIA or the FBI is the fact that they're not blaming Pakistan for having, they're not chasing them and not saying, why did you know he was there? They're just, they've done it, they're moving on, and they're not asking too many questions, which makes me think that maybe they did know, and maybe it was a tip-off with almost a plea bargain, you know, get him, leave me.
The whole thing's a little bit strange. I mean, the one thing that was noted was that there seems to be a lot of people that went off the record and spoke to American journalists on the basis of complete anonymity. They revealed their identity to them and said, you can never publish this. But they said that at first it was being reported that there'd been a struggle and he'd resisted arrest. But then someone went out with an anonymous source, went on air went and spoke to the papers and said, well, basically, no, we were told to go in, shoot to kill no matter what. And I mean, I can understand to an extent why you didn't want to take him as a civilian. Because, I mean, getting someone through an international war crimes trial in The Hague would have taken years.
I don't actually know the result of... Because someone said... I was speaking to someone the other day, they said, well, he would have been killed at The Hague. And I don't know if The Hague still has the death penalty, because the last people to go through The Hague and complete a trial of that high profile were the Nazi war criminals. Since then... I mean, there's been some, I can't think of any high profile cases, because the last one there was Milosevic, who died in cells.
Yeah, of course. And the same with Saddam, where they took him off.
And they left him to the Iraqis.
They left him to the Iraqis,
So I can't see this being resolved quickly.
No, I think what America probably thought is the killing of him would have been the best way to avoid a tense situation arising. I mean, if they kept bin Laden hostage for years and years in Guantanamo Bay,
there'll be escape attempts.
Would be escape attempts, there would be more bombs, there would be threats to getting back from Al-Qaeda. I think Al-Qaeda will probably just move on as an organisation as quickly as they can. And
very quickly, do you think a lot of people have been saying America and Britain are now safe? Do you think that's true?
No, I don't. I think, obviously, there are arrests at Sellafield nuclear plant on Monday afternoon, just hours after the news came out. There were five men sat in a van outside with video cameras filming the nuclear plant. So, and I know there have been other arrests around the globe, in Morocco and in America, under terrorism acts. So I think what it is, it's a symbolic victory for Britain and America, and I think it's going to... It boosts everyone's confidence that actually, you know, we are achieving something. This isn't just a pointless mission. Mm. Although I think now finding out that he wasn't in Afghanistan and was in Pakistan, that, you know, maybe throws people off a little bit. But I think it shows that, you know, David Cameron said it perfectly. It's a time now where everyone's got to be alert. We've got to keep our guard up. We can't let our guard fall. All in all, bin Laden was just a figurehead. He was a purely ceremonial figure. He wasn't the Al-Qaeda chief operative.
Just one of the heads on a many-headed dragon.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll say thank you to all of our guests for joining us. John Leach's interview, of course, was good to have on. Yeah. Also to David Simmons and Jay Patel.
Yes.
Thank you very much for joining us. It's been Brunel Questions.
We'll be back soon with, hopefully in the next few weeks, you'll hear from Jenny Jones, the London Assembly member. For the Green Party, leader of the Green Group, who could possibly be their mayoral candidate for 2012. And we'll also hear, hopefully, from Varalesh Shah, the Conservative MP, and Brunel graduate from Northwest Cambridgeshire, the MP for Northwest Cambridgeshire.
And also, we are on iTunes now. If you go onto iTunes store and type in Brunel Questions, it's all available online. All of our past shows and all of our previous interviews are going up as we speak. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. And we'll see you soon.